Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, February 5th, 2019, and you're listening to Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm your co-host, Carrie Klein, and I'm here with Alice Daniel.
Today on our show, we hear from a Navy veteran whose deportation case is galvanizing immigration advocates here in the Valley.
And later, we learn about a new storytelling initiative to get people talking about civil injustice.
But first, Fresno's no camping ordinance aimed at sprawling tent cities has been in effect for about a year and a half. Since then, the city has received millions in state funds to tackle homelessness issues. However, some would argue that policies like the no camping ban are making life more difficult for the homeless, and that the emergency money is only funding short-term fixes. FM89's Laura Satsui has this story.
Ray, who prefers to be on a first-name basis only, is laying on a mattress that sits directly on the sidewalk. There's no shelter, no tent. His makeshift bed is right outside the Poverello House, which provides meals and services for the homeless.
This is where I came, because I knew I could survive here.
It's not the first time Ray has been homeless, and he says he's on a waiting list for housing, but it could be a month or more until there's space available. So in the meantime, he's sleeping outside, where he says he sees police regularly.
I have done everything they've asked me to do. I have moved to the location I'm sitting in right now is where the officer that arrested me told me to set up my tent. Before that, he had me in the field across the way. Before that, it was across the street. Before that, it was in the field over here.
And that mattress he sleeps on, well, it's caused some problems. According to police records, Ray was arrested last week for obstructing public passageway. Once he was taken to jail, Ray was let go. But he had to leave his stuff back on that sidewalk, and he says it was gone when he returned.
Well, I've only been accumulating what I have since Tuesday. So they took everything I own, my bicycle, wheelchair, everything.
Ray says he can't get around without a wheelchair, so he's not moving far from this location anytime soon. He wants to charge his phone, but the library's a bit of a trek, and he doesn't want to leave his things behind.
I'm okay. I mean, you know, I'll be okay. I need to be in a situation where I'm not having repeated daily contact with law enforcement. Not in anybody's best interest.
We advise them of whatever the issue is that they may be violating, whether it's trespassing, whether it is a no camping ordinance violation. And they are most times very cooperative.
That's Lieutenant Rob Beckwith. He's in charge of the Fresno Police Department's Homeless Task Force. Beckwith says that in the last year, the force had over 9,000 contacts with homeless people, but Fresno's homeless population is only about 1,800 individuals, so many of those were repeat interactions. Beckwith says the idea is not to criminalize homelessness, but to make connections so people know what services are available.
What are people supposed to do if they can't camp and there aren't enough resources? I mean, is there an alternative for them?
There's always an alternative. We will find an alternative for them, but again, with less than 1% of those individuals wanting the services, that hasn't really been the issue.
In other words, he says very few homeless people accept the services he offers, but the executive director of Central California Legal Services thinks that it's worrisome how often homeless people are approached by law enforcement, even though officers are just doing their jobs.
There is no question that it is really hard to live in a community where there are a lot of people living on the street. To address the matter, it's not going to work for us to demonize those folks.
That's Patience Milrod. She says even with services, the city still seems to be missing what homeless people actually need, an affordable place to live.
As rents go up, homelessness increases. Big surprise, right? I mean, this is kind of economics 101. And unless and until we're prepared to put serious money into building housing for people and or preserving housing that is affordable to people at our clients' price point, then we're not going to fix the problem.
Councilmember Luis Chavez agrees that more affordable housing is needed, and the city should work with private companies to build it. But he says that such housing shouldn't just be focused in Southwest and Southeast Fresno.
And from my point of view, I think it's easier to place them on the corridors where we have transportation, we have services, we have amenities. So we need to figure out a way of placing these projects across the city.
Chavez voted in favor of the camping ban when it was proposed. He says he was responding to calls his office received about how homeless encampments had become problems for residents and businesses. And while the ban has made sprawling tent cities less likely, it's also made it harder to find large groups of homeless people. At least that's the case for the point in time count, where volunteers tally and survey the homeless population throughout Fresno County. I join a team in Northwest Fresno. We stop at a few parks, one in particular with few trees and an open field where we can see from one side of the street to the next.
Kind of not really anywhere for them to be.
Yeah.
That's Amy Bird, one of the volunteers. With a flashlight in her hand, she doesn't spot any homeless people. But right outside Fresno's newest Walmart, we meet a few people, including a man named Sean.
Hey guys, how are you? Are you currently homeless?
No, I just bought me a truck.
Okay, so you're living out of your truck.
But Sean and the other homeless people weren't camping in tents or sleeping in the street. And it's easier to move a car from place to place than just a mattress. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui. A Navy veteran who served 6 years in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan is asking Senator Dianne Feinstein to help him avoid deportation, and he's getting some strong support. Last week, he was the subject of a rally in front of the senator's Fresno office. The father of four has had some run-ins with the law, but he says he's making up for his past and wants to remain in the country where he's lived most of his life. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez has this story.
37-year-old Joaquin Antonio Sotelo Tarin points to the various medals pinned on the left side of his Navy uniform.
Operation War on Terrorism, Iraqi Freedom, this is Good Service Conduct, and National Defense Service Medal, and Sea Service Deployment Service Medal.
When Sotelo Tarin enlisted in the Navy, he had a green card. He was born in Mexico, but he hasn't lived there since he was about 9 years old. In 2005, he was honorably discharged from military service. And when he returned to the United States, he found civilian life difficult.
When I got out of the service, I came back with a lot of PTSD, alcoholism. So I did some wrongful decision making, and I got in trouble with the law.
According to Merced County Superior Court records, in 2008, Sotelo Tarin spent 6 months in jail after being convicted of a felony hit and run. He spent another 6 months in jail in 2009 for possessing a controlled substance. Then in 2014, he spent 18 months in prison for drug-related offenses and domestic violence. His attorney, Eaton Newman, says after Sotelo Tarin was released from prison in 2015, he was transferred to immigration custody. He was detained for about a year.
He finally got a hearing in front of an immigration judge who decided that he was appropriate for release and that he had shown rehabilitation, that he was committed to continuing his rehabilitation outside of detention.
Newman says his client has complied with everything the government has asked for, including rehabilitation. He's been sober since 2014. And on top of that, he's become an advocate. Newman says Sotelo Tarin spoke to legislators at the state capitol about immigrant and veteran rights. He even went to San Francisco City Hall to lobby for funding for legal resources for immigrants.
And yet ICE has continued since that bond hearing to try to appeal that decision and re-detain Joaquin and keep him in detention throughout the rest of his deportation proceedings and ultimately to try to deport him.
Andrew Arthur is a resident fellow of law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies. He says being a veteran doesn't prevent someone from being deported.
And if Congress wanted to specify that individuals who had served in the armed forces were not removable, they could do so, but there's no exception like that.
ICE has not responded to requests for a comment. And despite Sotelo Tarin's crimes, immigrant advocates in Fresno are mobilizing around him. A family physician from Merced, Salvador Sandoval, says the veteran has become a leader in his community.
Post-traumatic stress disorders associated with alcoholism, drug addiction, domestic problems. And all of these Joaquin went through, and Joaquin faced up to the problems that he had, and he's done marvelous things, showing that he has put that life behind him.
Brisa Cruz is with the California Immigrant and Youth Alliance. She helped organize the rally.
This shows that this community is with him, and community should still come out. This is only the beginning. This was the only, the very first gathering of many in the coming weeks.
Senator Feinstein's office says Sotelo Tarin has asked for casework assistance, but the senator won't discuss details about it because of privacy concerns. However, she only has the power to make inquiries with the Department of Homeland Security on someone's behalf. She can't stop someone from being deported. At the rally last week, Sotelo Tarin told the crowd that when he was in Iraq, he wondered what country would come and look for him if he were captured.
If I bleed, am I going to bleed the same color of my shipmate here around me or beside me? If I get killed, under what citizenship do I get killed? Not only that, but if I do kill, under what citizenship do I kill?
After he was done talking to the crowd, he gave a military salute and walked back to join his wife, mother, and sister. Sotelo Tarin's next immigration hearing is scheduled for February 11th. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
When police abuse their power and get disciplined for it, the public rarely finds out. For decades, California has had some of the most secretive laws when it comes to records about police misconduct. But now, under a new state transparency law, the public is finally getting to see inside the black box of these investigations. Capital Public Radio's Nadine Sabai and KQED's Suki Lewis take listeners inside the first complete internal affairs case files made public since SB 1421 went into effect on January 1st. It's all part of a statewide news effort, of which FM 89 is a part, to look into police misconduct. Sensitive listeners should be advised these records include some disturbing information and audio that shows unlawful arrest in the Delta town of Rio Vista.
Around 3 in the morning, Rio Vista police officers Man Lee and Natalie Rafferty show up at Catherine Jenks' house with their body cameras running, responding to her 911 call.
Police department. Did you call 911 again, Catherine?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
But now my alarm is off on my car. Why?
Okay, what was the issue?
The officers explain it's a crime to call 911 without a good reason.
If you're calling 911 to report something that's not of an emergency,
that's
a crime.
It is emergency.
Jenks tries to go back inside. Officer Rafferty stops her.
No. Come out here.
No, don't push me out here, lady.
Then Officer Lee pulls out his handcuffs.
Catherine.
Yeah?
I'm going to need you to put your hands behind your back, okay?
Why?
Because we're going to arrest you.
Dave!
Jenks calls for her boyfriend, David O'Reilly, who comes to the door.
Out!
Leave him alone.
Leave me alone!
Go inside. Stop biting me!
I haven't done anything!
More Rio Vista officers arrive and try to wrestle Jenks into custody. Nobody expected what happened next. Rafferty's police dog appearing in the dark. Jenks screams as the canine savagely bites her arm.
Get him off of me!
He's not on you. He's holding
on to your foot. Oh my God! No!
Months later, Jenks still remembers sitting in the back of the cop car as they took her away.
All I could do is see, oh my God, I still have my arm.
She was calling them for help, and they ended up brutalizing her and take her into jail.
Suki picks up the story about how the department responded.
The city hired Mark Siemens, a former police chief, to investigate if officers acted appropriately. Here's audio of Siemens interviewing Officer Lee.
After you received the call, did you have any discussion with Officer Rafferty about what you were going to do on the call?
I believe I mentioned to her that I plan on to arrest her.
Jenks' arrest was pre-planned. It was her 7th call in about a week and the 2nd call that day. From the IA interview tapes again.
Well, she was harassing law enforcement because she was calling 911, causing officers to respond to confirm that there was no crime occurring.
But Siemens found the officers shouldn't have arrested Jenks. She wasn't trying to harass them. She believed it was an emergency. The investigator also found that Rafferty tried to trump up the charges against Jenks by putting distorted information into police reports.
You say in the second paragraph, while holding Jenks' left arm, she bit my forearm, leaving teeth indentations. Mm-hmm. How painful was that bite?
It was painful.
Did it bruise?
No.
Rafferty and Lee submitted photos of these bites, but Siemens found the claim that they were injured by Jenks was exaggerated. The photos don't show any visible injuries. Jenks's bite from the police dog was really bad. The case file contains photos of massive wounds to her forearm. Rafferty said she didn't mean to press a button on her belt that released the dog. It happened on accident as she was struggling to contain Jenks. The police chief recently sent Rafferty a notice that he intends to fire her. She declined to comment for this story because she can still appeal that decision. Lee is no longer with the department.
We've had some turnover.
That's Rio Vista City Manager Robert Hickey.
And so you're going through a bit of a cultural change.
That may be something of an understatement. In this small department of just 14 people, a former chief and at least 7 officers have been fired or left the department since 2016. Additional administrative investigations are underway in the department, involving, according to the mayor, dozens of allegations officers have made against each other and current police chief Dan Daly. Hickey says he can't comment on any of the specifics of these cases, but he stands by the investigations.
I'm willing to ensure that investigations go forward as needed. I think that should give the public a good sense that the city here does take that responsibility very seriously.
But this whole process still seems to be missing a crucial step. When Nadine went by Catherine Jenks and her boyfriend O'Reilly's home recently, they had no idea there'd even been an investigation.
She tried to get a police report and they wouldn't give her one.
The couple says the department never questioned them about the incident, never told them how the police dog got out, and never offered Jenks counseling services.
It cost me $3,300 to get her out of jail that night. I wasn't going to leave her sitting in there.
Jenks still faces 6 misdemeanor charges for unlawful 911 calls, battery on each officer, and resisting arrest. She's set to appear in court in March. It'll be her 4th time. Jenks says her arm is still intensely painful and sometimes goes numb.
She has nightmares about it still. You know, she'll wake me up when I'm asleep because she'll be moaning and she's dreaming about the dog chewing on her arm.
She
sees the teeth.
As hard as it is for them to talk about, the couple says they're glad it's coming out now, so this kind of thing doesn't happen to someone else.
The police chief says he asked prosecutors to consider if the officers should face criminal charges for perjury and falsification of police reports. But a spokeswoman for the DA's office says her office never received the case about the officers' misconduct. I'm Suki Lewis, KQED News.
And I'm Nadine Sabai, Capital Public Radio News.
We all know someone who collects stuff. Maybe it's postcards or bumper stickers or antique figurines. Well, one San Joaquin Valley man has amassed quite an unusual collection of art and memorabilia. And this love has inspired a new business venture that has some people bristling. I visited him at his home to learn more. The frenetic energy of William Harder's life begins before you even enter his home, with his dogs, their little heads crowding the front window. Inside, Harder himself joins in.
Puppies, please, oh no.
At the Ouija board welcome mat, he asks me to take off my shoes, offers me coffee, then hurries into a back room.
I got one thing I gotta get. Hang on, just go. One more thing, and then we'll sit down.
While we talk, he compulsively arranges his thousands of DVDs and straightens out the photos and band posters and art and miniature spoons that crowd every inch of his walls.
The 3 in the middle or 4 tiles are Pablo Picasso prints. Got those when I lived in Spain.
He's got a Lagunitas beer cap on the fridge. There's a story to that, too, from the last time he drank over a year ago.
I haven't had a drink since the day Manson died.
He's talking about notorious killer and cult leader Charles Manson.
When he passed, I wanted something good to come from it.
Harder has a fascination with serial killers, why they do what they do. He visited Manson regularly in prison. They built up a kind of trust. Manson wrote letters and sent artwork, much of which is now on Harder's wall.
There's several string arts. There's two dolls. The earrings were beaded by Manson.
Harder came to be a collector of what's called murder memorabilia in a display case next to the Satanic Bible and a preserved slice of a human brain is a little orange bottle.
I have a Dr. Jack Kevorkian, one of his old prescription bottles for his blood pressure medication. Right next to that, oddly enough, is some mortuary cosmetics.
On another wall, a childlike, colorful painting.
That's an actual John Wayne Gacy, Pogo the Clown.
Gacy, who dressed as Pogo to lure his victims. Harder doesn't just collect this stuff, he also deals in it. From his home, he runs an e-commerce site called Murder Auction. It's kind of like eBay, but for things related to, well, murders. It's one of a handful of sites that sell clothing and letters and even fingernail clippings from murderers and victims. Harder says he doesn't sell his personal collection, but this all led him to his newest venture.
So I got an email from this guy saying, hey, I'd like to make serial killer bobbleheads. I mean, I think it'd be a great thing. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
They're called Psycho Killer Bobbleheads. Extremely detailed figurines of 16 of the most notorious murderers. And who's that one?
That is H.H. Holmes. One of America's first serial killers.
There's Charles Manson with his tongue sticking out, Ted Bundy with a cast and crutch, and gray-haired Dorothea Puente, who killed and buried her renters in order to cash their Social Security checks.
I mean, these are kind of satirical. They're meant to be, you know, yeah, it's dark humor, but it, you know, they're not meant to be taken super seriously like the Jeffrey Dahmer. He's wearing a T-shirt that says Bon Appetit.
You seem to have more empathy for serial killers than you do for the victims' families.
That's not my job.
Harder's been interviewed many times by the media. That's him on a TV show called Crime Watch Daily in 2015. In that same show, he sparred with Andy Kahn, a victims' advocate with Crime Stoppers in Houston, Texas.
Their loved one didn't die so that you could profit from selling personalized items.
But everybody does, whether it's books, documentaries.
There's a big difference.
It's the same.
Public record.
It's the books.
Harder places murder memorabilia within the much larger true crime industry. And then it becomes a business ethics question. If an industry exists, who's more responsible? The suppliers of the product or the customers clamoring for it? Andy Kahn, the victim's advocate, doesn't care about the answer. He's been trying to shut this industry down for years.
Quite frankly, there's nothing more nauseating and disgusting to find out the person who murdered one of your loved ones now has items being hawked by third parties for pure profit. It's like being gutted all over again by our criminal justice system.
In the early 2000s, Kahn's lobbying led eBay to ban murder memorabilia. One could argue that's what led to independent sites like Murder Auction popping up. But this industry isn't new. One of the earliest documented cases happened almost three centuries ago.
There was a case, a famous case in the 1800s, a murderer called William Corder.
Jack Denham is a criminologist at York St. John University in the UK. He says in 1827, Corder shot and killed his lover in a barn. He was hanged for it a year later.
People would sell fragments of the barn and also would turn his murder into a stage production and a theater production that kind of toured around the United States.
Later, people would attend public executions in droves. Denham agrees with Harder that there is no hard line between murder memorabilia and true crime, especially since criminals today get to be famous just for being famous, like many other modern celebrities.
If we're going to celebrate criminals and turn them into celebrities, in film and in popular culture, then you can't expect people to treat them any differently to how they treat celebrities who weren't criminals. And people collect things associated with normal celebrities all the time.
In late January, the streaming service Netflix debuted a TV series about serial killer Ted Bundy. A few days later, the service urged viewers to stop tweeting about how attractive he was.
We have a front label and a back label for each bobblehead box.
For his part, William Harder asserts he doesn't glorify killers. He even likens these collectibles to war memorabilia, collecting a piece of the Berlin Wall or a musket from the Civil War. And he has a message for those who don't like his bobbleheads.
Don't come to my website. I'm not asking you to buy them. If you think it's, you know, star killer worship, that's great. Fortunately for me, I don't seek validation from other people. I don't do this for anybody else. This I'm doing to make money. And believe me, there's plenty of people buying them.
Plenty of people, he says, as he prepares 5 more bobbleheads to be shipped. He launched the site in December, and he estimates he's sold at least 70 already. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This Saturday, a group of writers, educators, and artists will tell personal stories about social injustice in front of an audience at Fresno State. It's called Storytelling for Change, and it's part of a larger effort to get people talking about present-day civil liberties struggles and how they connect to the Japanese-American incarceration during World War II. I recently spoke with Bryn Saito and Nikiko Masamoto, the architects of the Yonsei Memory Project.
Let's start by having you briefly introduce yourselves.
Sure. My name is Bryn Saito, and I recently joined the faculty, the English department at Fresno State. So I teach there, and I'm also a poet and a writer.
And my name is Nikiko Masamoto. I'm an organic farmer out in Del Rey in the Valley, and I'm also an artist.
Wonderful. Tell us, how did Storytelling for Change come about?
Yeah, so we started Storytelling for Change last fall. I think both of us are interested in storytelling and the power of stories. And we've seen that stories can be very transformative and healing for communities. So we wanted to get a bunch of wonderful, diverse folks together to learn how to tell powerful stories and perform them.
And performing them is very different from writing a story. It's a whole different medium. Can you give us an example, Nikiko, of how you take a memory and turn it into storytelling?
Yeah, Bryn and I designed a series of workshops to help community members. So our fellows are everyone from Reedley College and Fresno State students all the way up to 80-year-olds in our Japanese-American community. So we designed this series of workshops so that anyone coming into storytelling could be able to learn some tools to craft a story. So some of those exercises look like thinking about approaching storytelling for performance through three kind of narrative of three arcs. One, we talked about the arrival moment. So opening up your story with a single moment that helps the audience place themselves. And one of the differences we discussed, Bryn is an accomplished writer, and one of the differences between, I think, designing a story for live performance versus the page is that you actually don't need to give the full scope of detail of the arrival moment. You just need enough to place the audience with you. We use the metaphor of building a house. You don't actually need to fill in the entire house. You just need to provide the frame. So after the arrival moment, we taught our storytellers to choose or design a moment of change or choice in their story, whether it was their own change or choice or someone, another character, another person in their story. And then finally, inviting them to close with some type of reflection, which didn't have to be a perfect summation of anything that happened, but definitely like a landing point where the audience could breathe and exhale and bring a message out of the story.
And you call it the Yonsei Memory Project. Can you explain to the audience what that means?
Yes. So Yonsei is means fourth generation Japanese American, and Nikiko and I are both Yonsei. So the Issei was the first generation that came over from Japan. The Nisei were born here. Sansei third, and then Yonsei fourth generation. And so we came together a couple years ago, I think, realizing there was a lot of sort of generational shift happening in our community. A lot of the Nisei who were incarcerated were, you know, they're getting older. They're passing on. And we, as Yonsei, were thinking, wow, how do we really start to carry the memories forward of that experience and also begin to connect it to current civil liberties struggles?
Right. And when you say incarcerated, you mean during World War II?
Yes. Yeah, so the Nisei were incarcerated, imprisoned in the internment camps as part of the kind of West Coast evacuation of over 120,000 Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor happened.
So, Nikiko, I know that you're trying to link in some ways the injustice of that to people's experiences in terms of civil liberties struggles now. Can you give me an example of someone's story that the audience will hear?
Well, immediately, two of our storytellers are Nisei, so they're talking about their memory of suffering through racism during World War II and actually after World War II. And in their stories, they make really explicit linkages to language, rhetoric, and policy that are alive and well, unfortunately, today. The use of executive order, once again, to create policy that is xenophobically motivated. Right now, it's so painful to hear the discussions of citizenship questions on the census, because we know historically Census Bureau data was used to design the maps that imprisoned our families. So these connections are made by the storytellers themselves. The diversity of our storytellers is incredible. There's a white man who's a storyteller who talks about his perspective as someone outraged by racism and what his positionality is, specifically in relationship to the border. And it's a really, really poignant example of the type of conversations that can unfold when stories are allowed to take their full scope.
And there were 14 people who participated in Storytelling for Change, and 11 of them will be performing February 9th at Fresno State at Madden Library. Bryn, is there a particular story that really moved you?
You know, I was thinking about one of our younger storytellers, who's a Fresno State student, Noemi, and not so much her story, which is incredibly powerful and really about a sort of a young woman of color coming into her own, finding her voice, but something she shared afterwards about the fellowship, about how her experience in the fellowship, learning in this intergenerational setting, learning these tools, learning to put stories at the center of her life, helped her communicate better with her family. And with her peers, like she found herself sitting at dinner and asking her family about their stories. She said she learned to be brave enough to start to ask questions and just be curious about everybody's story that was around her. So that was such a beautiful moment for us, I think, as the facilitators, to see the ways in which these skills are growing and these students and fellows we've worked with are carrying these skills into their communities.
Because, of course, that's one of your missions, right, is to get people to connect with each other through story. It was originally slated for last fall, this project, Storytelling for Change, but it was canceled due to vandalism at the original venue, the Fresno Soap Company. That must have been an awful experience, because the people who are telling these stories are already vulnerable. And then to have that happen right before the show was about to go on, what was your reaction to that? How did you feel?
At first, I think we were all shocked. And once we kind of leaned into understanding what really had transpired just 48 hours before we were supposed to open our performance, we relied on our storytelling skills. And we gathered our fellows in Bryn's apartment, and we just spent hours making space for us to talk about what this experience was like. And Bryn and I, as facilitators and co-directors of Yonsei Memory Project, we didn't make the decision to restage the performances. The fellows did as a group. And we asked them openly, you know, with this, the reality of this world and right here in Fresno, this vandalism that all of a sudden injected itself into our lives, what would you like to do? What would make you feel the most meaningful, the safest? And everyone in one choral, beautiful moment said, we must tell our stories.
That's wonderful. Bryn, let me ask you one more question. What does storytelling do for communities, especially this kind of performative storytelling?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly powerful and healing to hear these, have these stories be surfaced, have them be told. There are community members, family members who will come and sit there in the audience and hear some of these stories for the first time. And there is sort of an intergenerational healing, I think, that happens through that. We've seen that with our work in Yonsei Memory Project. Part of this project was inspired by the storytelling we did within the Japanese American community in intergenerational settings. And we saw the ways in which some of these stories that had never been told after camp were finally told and surfaced, and the younger folks could hear the stories, and there was a lot of just release and healing that happened from that process. So we're seeing the same things happening, I think, with storytelling for change.
I think that's a good point. I mean, a lot of people just don't know what their parents or grandparents experienced. Mm-hmm. And until you start telling stories, you can't know.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much, Bryn and Nakiko. Again, the Yonsei Memory Project Storytelling for Change will take place February 9th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Fresno State's Henry Madden Library. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
When you think of civil rights leaders from the Central Valley, names like Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta probably come to mind. But another fundamental figure in the farm labor movement was Larry Itliong. The Filipino activist co-founded the United Farm Workers of America and was pivotal in the Delano grape strike. His life was recently memorialized in a children's book called Journey for Justice, The Life of Larry Itliong. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke to one of the authors, Gail Romasanta, about what it was like to write the first book recounting Itliong's impact in the Central Valley. Gail Romasanta, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
So this is the first children's book written about the United Farm Workers co-founder, Larry Itliong, who played a large role, obviously, in the civil rights movement for labor workers in the Central Valley. What made you want to be a part of even writing this book and kind of putting this history in a format for children?
You know, this is actually the first book written about Larry Itliong. After all these years, this is the only book, and Dr. Don Mabalon was the leading historian researching him and his work and writing about him. And so what made me want to do it really was out of a need to solve my own problems at home, because my kids would come home and they needed to write about a famous person, and they would have lists of people and no one that they could identify with. And I searched and looked for a book about Larry Itliong, and there was none. And I kind of knew that there was no book about him, but I was floored when it turned out to be true. You know, after all the years that I knew there wasn't a book about him, I was floored that there still wasn't a book about him. And so I called Dawn about writing the children's book. She was writing the college version of her research on Larry. And she said yes. So we went to work on it right away. We wanted to write it before someone wrote it incorrectly, or someone that was not from the community wrote it incorrectly.
Filipino community, you mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. So we felt like we needed to be the ones. Don was the one who was researching him for decades and piecing together his story. We were afraid that if someone else did it, they would put out the incorrect history, mm-hmm. Or they would, silence us again, mm-hmm. With incorrect facts.
Can you talk about who Larry Itliong was? So I know that he's buried in Delano, but he immigrated from the Philippines. And how does the Central Valley fit into his story?
When he got to the United States, he was 15 years old, and he boarded the Empress of Asia, a boat or a ship with everyone coming here. And then he went to Seattle. And then he went all over as a farm laborer. And then he also worked in Alaska. And so he was a laborer. He had started other unions and other organizations. For instance, in Alaska, he had started a union for the cannery workers. And he really was an activist. He was a union organizer, but he was also, just an activist for the community from the get-go. And so being the leader for the Delano grape strike wasn't just in that time and moment. He was doing this for most of his life. And so he had actually been the leader for the Delano grape strike, and the Filipino American farm workers had voted September 7th, 1965 to go on strike against the growers. Larry had called Cesar Chavez to invite the Mexican American workers to go on strike with them. And so the Mexican American workers joined the strike. And that's when the Delano grape strike happened. And then you know, they formed together, the Mexican-Americans and the Filipinos, you know, joined together, and the UFW was started with Cesar as the director and Larry as the co-director. All these years, we've heard stories about Cesar, and we've heard, you know, we've read, and communities have talked about the importance of the UFW and Cesar Chavez and what had gone on during the Delano grape strike. But there is really, I want to say, a lack of recognition of Larry and his work and of Filipino Americans.
Wow. Yeah, that really leads into my next question, which is just why in the first place maybe was he overlooked?
You know, that is actually, there's so many reasons. And I had asked Dawn this, like one of the first things, one of our first meetings, I was like, girl, why have we not been talked about? Why is Larry's work,
it's almost like he's absent from that narrative of,
yes, absolutely. And so, you know, it was because there was no book. Mm-hmm. Philip Veracruz, who was also part of that movement, has a book. He had written his own book and Larry didn't. And also there's many different things that might have been going on. The media may not have wanted to get him on camera, or they didn't want to forward the story. It wasn't sexy enough to have an aging farm workers to highlight them in media reels, because the Filipinos were an older workforce and Larry was older. So maybe they didn't want to put them on camera, or they didn't want to forward that story or that narrative. It wasn't one reason. Mm. You know, he was interviewed. We do know that. There's transcripts at the UFW archives at Wayne State University in Detroit. I mean, there's archives of him doing interviews, but they were shelved. They were not used.
Mm. I know that civil rights and social justice is a concept that, you know, gets kind of brought up quite a lot these days, I think, in different areas, but it's something adults talk about a lot. I'm curious, why did you think this was something you could make for kids? Or did you feel like you had to pare it down a little bit? How did you make this something that kids could definitely grasp?
I think we first had to do a vomit draft. We had to put everything out there of all the history that Dawn had in her mind, in her notes, everything that she collected. And she's a professional historian, so it wasn't like she read this information anywhere. She actually had to find it. She had to find it through public records. She had to find it through court documents. She found it through letters, and not just letters from Larry, but letters of other people talking about certain issues or certain situations or things that happened. She had to get them from meeting notes. She got transcripts. I mean, just a wealth of information that Dawn had to look through. And Dawn would always say, like, these are the things that people would thought, you know, would throw away or were garbage, but it's actually historical documentation of what had happened. So she actually knitted all of this together. It wasn't, I mean, when you read this book and when you look this book, you have to understand a Panay PhD from Stanford knit all this information together. So any story that comes after this first book about Larry Itliong, all that information that people are getting about Larry is going to come from this book. There is no other historian that was writing about Larry and really finding the information like Dr. Don Mabalan was.
Mm.
Yeah, and you know, why we wanted to do it for kids, why I wanted to do it for kids. At first, you know, Don was just going to do a college book, but I really wanted to do it for kids because no one was demanding that our Filipino American history gets to our children at the youngest age that we possibly can get it to. Right now, the only access we have to our Filipino American history that is taught in colleges, that is taught, you know, at institutions, or, you know, that is institutionalized somewhere, is just at the college level. It's not at, you know, our children who are, you know, from K through 14 or K through 12. So I felt that that is very important as someone who wrote about education, as a writer about education, which is what I've done in my own career, and as a writer in general, and as a mom of four children. This was very important to me.
Wow. And I think this is a great place where we're going to have to leave it, but we have been talking about the recently published children's book, Journey for Justice, The Life of Larry Itliong. It was written by Dr. Don Mabalon and Gail Romasanta, illustrated by Andre Sabayon. The book's tour kickoff and Delano pilgrimage start this Friday, and those events will continue throughout the weekend. But Gail Romasanta, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, and thank you for having me, Laura.
An extended version of that interview can be found on our website.
Sometimes courageous, noble, hardworking people grab the headlines, but most of the time their work goes unsung. They're the teachers, organizers, artists, and more who help to make places like Fresno better. Well, now some of these local heroes are being celebrated in a new portrait series that opens at Art Hop this Thursday at Bitwise South Stadium. The show is called Unmask, and it's the brainchild of photographer Enrique Meza and Bitwise CEO and co-founder Jake Soberall. I recently spoke with Soberall about how this project evolved. So, Jake, what's the genesis of this project? How did this collaboration come about?
Yeah, so Enrique Meza, who is just a super talented photographer, and I have been close friends for about a decade. And in that time, our careers have evolved from very early days, me as an attorney, him as a commercial real estate photographer, to today him running Meza and me with Irma running Bitwise. And as those careers have evolved, we've also seen Fresno evolve. And just last fall, Enrique and I were visiting and talking about just how many really neat things we were seeing in the community that many times were going uncelebrated. And so we began dreaming around an idea, well, how could we celebrate people who are, you know, heroes in our city that don't get a lot of limelight? And so we dreamt up this exhibit that we're calling Unmasked, where we have an opportunity to tell their stories and feature them visually in a way that is really fun and heroic.
So these are people who are working long hours in the trenches, helping others, but they're kind of unsung. They don't get the recognition they deserve. How do you winnow it down to the 26 you chose?
So we began with a solicitation for nominations. So we sent emails out to folks from all over the community trying to reach intentionally into diverse pockets. And what we ask is that they would nominate people who were doing important, good, hard, sometimes messy work in the community that doesn't get a lot of attention. That elicited more than 100 nominations, which was really fun to see. And then from there, we convened a small group of folks that we really respect, including Enrique and I, and said, let's winnow this down to a group of 25. We of course, wound up at 26. And let's do that by trying to assemble a group that is representative of the rich diversity in our community and truly are folks that just don't get celebrated or wouldn't run into an opportunity to be celebrated absent something like this. And so that led to this collection of individuals, and we just couldn't be more thrilled with the list.
And you're calling it Unmasked. And is it Unmasked just because you're letting people know about these unsung heroes who maybe haven't been in the limelight before? Or is there another reason for calling it Unmasked?
Yeah, Unmasked was drawing on that imagery of a hero and the notion that in their very, very important, as I described, sometimes messy daily work, these folks are kind of, by virtue of not being celebrated, masked, right? They are the silent heroes in our community. And that by celebrating them in this way and portraying them in this really regal portrait, we're sort of unmasking them, and you get to see the person behind the work.
So you said regal portrait. What do you mean?
Yeah, the portraits that we have done, I think, will strike folks as the sort that are usually reserved for world leaders and conquering generals, dignitaries. And that's not to say that these folks aren't every bit as important. It is to say, though, that their careers wouldn't ordinarily put them on a collision course for this sort of portrait. And so the opportunity to feature them in this way is really fun, and we think that they are extraordinarily deserving of this and more.
Okay, I'm going to throw out some names of people who will be in the exhibit, and if you can just tell me in a sentence or two why they're heroes. Okay, so Whitney Bunker, City Without Orphans.
Whitney is phenomenal. She has been the power behind an organization that is doing more with foster youth than just about anybody else in our city.
Wayne Hurley, Dance Empowerment.
Wayne is so fun. So Wayne has spent his entire career connecting with youth and trying to keep them out of trouble and engaged in healthy activities through the art of dance. And as I said, he is just such a fun guy.
Richard, is it Burrell?
Yes. Richard is not only a former gang member, but formerly incarcerated. And his exceptional story is one in which he decided not only to change his life, but to spend his entire life working with youth that were on a collision course for those same outcomes along Motel Row. And he is just so, so good at that work.
Right. And I should mention his program or his organization is called Live Again Fresno. So let me give you just a couple more. How about Eddie Valero, Tulare County?
When Eddie walks into a room, that entire room lights up. So he is a local guy who went to Cornell University, came back and invested the early part of his career standing up a youth mentorship program in Orosi, and then was inspired to run for Tulare County Board of Supervisors and won. There isn't anything in Eddie's story that would make him the likely politician, but it would be difficult to imagine somebody better suited to represent the people of his county. And Eddie is just this beautiful, beautiful human being.
What about Mai Tao, Hmong Innovating Politics?
Mai, I'm just getting to know, but she is a powerhouse that is working to establish and grow voice for the Hmong community in politics, not just here in Fresno, but also in Sacramento.
And do you see this as something that will continue next year and the year beyond?
That's a curiosity of ours. It has just been really, really fun to tell these stories. And so whether in this format or another, I'm excited to do it again. And I know Enrique is as well. One thing that is worth mentioning is that coupled with the Art Hop, we have two local musicians, Patrick Contreras and Hope Garcia, doing a violin and vocal duet at the Art Hop. And there will be food from Taste Kitchen, coffee from US Bean, and cocktails from Cocktails I Do. So we're really hopeful that it will be a fun party to accompany this neat celebration of local heroes.
Okay, great. Let's remind our listeners that Unmask opens February 7th at Bitwise South Stadium as part of this month's Art Hop. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Absolutely.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Carrie Klein, reporters Monica Velez and Laura Sitsui. Our audio engineer is Marv Ellen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.